and welcome to another Monday morning Book of Mormon class with Kevin Hinckley. Recorded live, we dive deeply and deliberately into this inspired scripture. How far we get in one class depends a lot on the material and the doctrines left for us by ancient prophets. A single chapter may occupy one class or many. Of course, opinions expressed by the teacher or the class members do not constitute official church doctrines. Join us in this adventure and discover the hidden treasures found within his pages. And now, on to the class. And welcome to another summer. Class isn't in session, but we have a chance to look at some things related to church history that are interesting to us over the summer before we begin again this fall. Today we're going to try and answer one of those intriguing questions that, where we're not going to come up with a great answer. Okay, and that is, where exactly, if you believe that the Book of Mormon is historical and actually took place, most members do, where exactly did Nephi live? Where exactly did the Book of Mormon take place? Now, we can go ahead and begin with the normal disclaimer that, yes, the only way to know that the Book of Mormon is true is reading it, praying about it, and having the Spirit confirm to us that it's true. Okay? So, it isn't like we're holding off on evidence of the Book of Mormon until we actually find that sign located somewhere that says, "Welcome to Zarahemla, next exit." Because that just isn't going to happen. It appears at this point that the Lord doesn't intend that that's ever going to happen. That evidence for the Book of Mormon will always be by the Spirit and not because we have overwhelming evidence of it. However, so that said, knowing that this is true, it's easy to in the readings of the early church members that they were very interested in where the Book of Mormon possibly might have taken place. So there was a lot of early speculation. That's why over time, and this mound just south of Manchester near Palmyra, instead of being just the mound where Joseph is going to find the plates, is actually named by the members as Cumorah, because in the early days they really, really wanted to see the Book of Mormon taking place in North America, in up around upstate New York and some parts east or west of that. And certainly there's a large group out there today promoting what we call the Heartland model that really wants to see all of the Book of Mormon take place in the area of upper New England and going west. I would say that the Heartland model, the idea that it takes place in the United States, if you take a look at most serious Book of Mormon scholars, that's probably way down the third on the list. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time today on the Heartland model because I just don't find it that compelling because there's so much evidence in our two other models that we're going to take a look at today. So that said, when we start looking around, I would say that most pretty competent Book of Mormon scholars want to place the actual historical events of the Book of Mormon somewhere in Mexico and the Yucatan. How come? Well, let's begin with the fact that there are some real similarities. Real quickly, probably the oldest civilization that we know of in the Americas, running concurrent with Mesopotamia, was down north of Lima in Peru, known as the Supercorel, or the Corel civilization, and they are about 3000 BC. And they're building temple complexes and temples, and they have a variety of gods related to the weather, but we don't have a lot of information about the Corel. but we know that they are down there and that area is being constantly excavated. Probably the next most noticeable, if we come back up to the area around southern Mexico and the Yucatan, we're going to run into the Olmecs. And those Olmecs are very interesting. They have, as their god, a very early version of the Aztec god, Quetzalcoatl. Quetzalcoatl is a combination of the Quetzal, taken from the Quetzal bird, which has beautiful plumage, long, very beautiful plumage coming from this bird, the Quetzal bird. And then they're going to combine that with Quetzalcoatl, the serpent. So it becomes the feathered serpent. And of the Olmec that are coming very early, we think somewhere around 1600 BC, they are going to have an early version of Quetzalcoatl. It's not very developed, but especially as you get down towards southern Mexico, Palenque, down that area, you're going to see a lot of broad-faced Olmec creatures, Olmec people. If you've ever been out to Belize and out to the city of Lamanai, you can go to a Olmec, the Temple of the Mask site, the burial of an Olmec, prominent Olmec person, located in a Mayan city. That is the city of Lamanai. It's a short river trip outside of Lamanai. A lot of cruise groups will go out to the city of Lamanai. Wonderful place. And intriguing when you start looking at some of the architecture there. Certainly when we get to the Aztecs, and now we're a thousand years, a couple of thousand years later, by the time we get to the Aztecs, and we have Quetzalcoatl, and you see the feathered serpent everywhere on the face of temples. If you've been to the city of Teotihuacan in outside Mexico City, this is a city where men become gods. We don't find a place, not a lot of battlements, not a lot of protections. This is a place that seems to have been more of a city of priests. And I would think a lot of Book of Mormon scholars wonder about something like Teotihuacan, maybe the city of Bountiful, because it would have been in the land northward walls and signs of weapons, but a place where people come to become godlike. So there's a lot that we have more on the Aztecs and that god Quetzalcoatl. Now, for those that want to see the Book of Mormon, maybe not so much up towards Mexico, but maybe more up onto the Yucatan, now you get into a close similarity to Quetzalcoatl, and that is in the Mayan god Kukulcan. When the priest of the Spanish conquerors came to Mayaville, to the Yucatan, they found a lot of rich histories that weren't written down. They didn't have a written history of their people. Later, they were going to find those more in Guatemala. They will find and in Mesoamerica, they will finally find written accounts of their gods. But at first, they don't see it. So the Mayan, for the Spanish priests, are going to these Mayan wise men and having them dictate their history of their people. And then he will then publish that in the 1500s, and he will call it Popovu. And Popovu, which you can actually Google, guys, go online, and you can actually pull up. They're printed versions of Popovu, telling the history of the Mayans and their gods. The thing that always confused everybody was and led to great skepticism is that they had the history, for instance, of the what we call the heroic twins, the creation myth of the Mayans in Popovu, of these heroic twins that fight in the underworld prior to this life. They come to this life, and the one God is able to put down the other, and he will create people first of stone and then of dirt and ultimately of maize, of corn, and he will create people. But he'll teach them how to farm, and he's going to teach them how to do a number of things. If you go to places all over in Mayaville around the Yucatan, you're going to find all this. You'll find signs of Popovu. One of the more intriguing sites that we have with this, though, is as archaeologists have been working hard to excavate certain sites within the middle of the Yucatan, some of the oldest temples are being able to be found. And the assumption was that they weren't going to find Popovu in these temples because they were very ancient. And of course, Popovu is going to describe things like these twins. They're going to describe things like a flood, you know, of a white god that came and visited. And they're thinking, you know what? This is Catholic storytelling that is mixing with the Mayan history to kind of give it a Christian slant. So anything related to kind of Popovu is probably Christian tainted, and it probably wasn't really Mayan myth. Then when they start excavating these massive temples in the middle of the Yucatan, and they get down to the base of it where they've already agreed, yes, this is a pre-classic, much older, 400 BC temple. What do they find carved into the bottom of these massive temples? Popovu and the heroic twins. And suddenly sites like, if you've ever been to Chichen Itza, were probably one of the largest ballparks, ball courts ever found among the Mayas. The ball court being that place where the battle between the heroic twins is played out. And they're going to play back and forth till one of them is killed in that ball court. You get this massive ball court with places for thousands of people to watch the games. It's kind of their coliseum, if you will. Carved into the far end of that ball court is an image high up on the side. And guides, if you're ever in Chichen Itza, guides can show you where that is. And you will see a bearded god figure carved in the top there. Interesting things about that is, A, the Mayans didn't have beards, and it looked very beard-like. And you see this image of a god overseeing the events in the ball court. Okay. Interesting, because that matches up with some of the things coming from Mexico, where if you go to the Mexico City Museum, they have a wonderful tapestry that shows the coming of the people to Mexico. And one of the things that they have is they show a man that is leading the birthing people, they say, into the land of Mexico, and he's carrying an instrument that they refer to as the Gran Gagal, which is technically translated as a compass or a director. And this compass or director led them to this place of safety. And you can see them then going forth from this place led by the Gran Gagal, where they're going to celebrate the coming of the people. And again, if you're looking for some signs of Book of Mormon-ness, suddenly these things start to jump out. Now, we do have to be careful. Let me just say this. The archaeologists and Book of Mormon archaeologists will use an important word, and it's called diffusionism. What does that mean? That means that when there are stories that are told of actual events that may have happened several millennia earlier, that over time, parts and parcels of these actual events start to weave themselves into the myths and stories and tales and traditions that are told hundreds and thousands of years later. So what you're going to generally get, because there's not a digital copy of that original event, you're going to see bits and pieces like a tapestry woven into their stories. So you can see, so what you're always looking for when you're looking at these creation stories and the stories of their people is you're going to see bits and pieces and threads of probably a truthful event surrounded by later events. That's diffusionism. So the idea of a flood that maybe earlier occurred ends up in flood myths 1,000 years later, but given different circumstances and different gods ordered it, but you find this flood or you find the heroic twins and you get a sense of something maybe back to Genesis, but you're going to see it woven into tightly into whatever myths they're telling based on that part of the country and the things that they're believing and the things that the kings have been told. So always, 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 when we're looking at places where maybe the Book of Mormon might have occurred or that they might have been influenced by early stories related to the coming of Book of Mormon people, it is woven together with Mayan and Aztec and Zoltec and Peruvian myths. So it's never going to be completely intact. It's always diffused thousands of years later. So you just look for signs, if that certainly makes sense. So again, and I've traveled a lot in Mesoamerica, I get a chance to see this, and I see these threads of tapestry that mixed in with this. Makes it really kind of fun to go, oh, that could, there could be a part there as maybe you're visiting these Mayan sites, whether it's Chichen Itza or Progreso or even in sites like Cozumel and things like, you'll find these areas. Okay, now one of the more intriguing cases that we get is when we actually start taking a look at the case for Peru. Now let me stop for a sec. It doesn't matter, guys, and this is really kind of an important point, and I hope you'll hang with me on this. One of the important points, whether you're a Heartlander, seeing the Book of Mormon taking place in Northern America, whether you are a Mesoamerican, Mayan, Aztec believer that maybe the Book of Mormon took place there, or where I kind of lean more kind of in direction of Peru, is the fact that there's always a question that gets asked. And that is that we have, at the end of the Book of Mormon, we have this question that's always asked, which is, Moroni is going to finish the plates. Moroni is going to bury the plates in a hill where Joseph Smith is going to be able to find it. So that means that ultimately we need to place Moroni at the end of his life near and up in the area around Palmyra, upstate New York. And in the early days of the church, there's some comments made during the Zion's camp trek from Kirtland out to Missouri. Joseph is going to make some comments in those early days, believing that, saying, probably happened here, and this is where we're going to get these stories of Zelph the Lamanite, and he's seeing it in that context. Now, about 10 years later, he will begin to see it in a much different place, but those early comments are based in North America, and one of the reasons why people want to go there, it's like we have to, it's got to be possible for Moroni to walk with a heavy set of plates and make it to Palmyra, where he can bury them in the hill nearby where Joseph Smith at a future date is going to live. Now, let me remind us of something that happened actually in 1829. And that is that Joseph, after he gives up the plates, or after he gives up the 116 pages to Martin Harris, Martin Harris is going to lose them. We will have the loss of the 116 pages. And one of the consequences of that for Joseph is that Moroni, this resurrected being, will come to Joseph, and he says he had to give to the angel Moroni the plates. So angel Moroni is going to take the plates from Joseph, hold on to them for a few months, and then bring them back in late 1828. And now think about what that means. What that means is that we have a resurrected being that can show up and can take the plates and carry the plates and take them somewhere else and then show up again to give them back to Joseph Smith. What that means is that resurrected beings can carry around gold plates, which then really means that whether Moroni dies in Kansas or whether he dies in Cusco or whether he dies in Palenque, Mexico, he could have buried the plates. He could have died. And then when he knew where Joseph Smith was going to end up, and turned out it was going to be in the area around Palmyra, and there was a place where the plates could be buried, he could have literally, as a resurrected being, have taken those plates from wherever he buried them and transferred them to a hill nearby where this boy is going to be able to carefully have a short visit down the Canandaigua Road and climb the hill and go ahead and pull those plates up. So really, what is really a non sequitur here is that wherever Moroni dies, wherever the Book of Mormon takes place, Moroni as a resurrected being could have transferred those plates, wherever he buried them, in whatever continent almost, and taken them to upstate New York where Joseph Smith would be able to find them. So for me, guys, where Moroni buries them and dies doesn't really matter in where it is that the Book of Mormon possibly took place. Okay. Now, so let's now take just a second and make the case a bit for the fact that the Book of Mormon could have, first of all, taken place in Peru, and then maybe that Jesus is then going to visit Mexico and maybe even North America, but that the Book of Mormon first takes place, that the Book of Mormon story is actually going to take place in Peru. And certainly if you talk to any saints in Cusco, they will tell you exactly why. And they have some pretty good evidences to back that up. I want to take just a second and read something from 1550. This is Pedro de la Sueza de León, who's going to describe the stories that he's hearing as he's traveling with Pizarro and they are conquering the Incas in Peru. And he's going to say, quote, "There came from a southern direction," this is their creation myth, right? "There came from a southern direction a white man of great stature, who by his aspect and presence called forth great veneration and obedience. This man, who appeared to have great power, insomuch that he could change plains into mountains, great hills into valleys, and make water flow out of stones." Sounds pretty biblical, doesn't it, at this point? Okay, then he goes on. "As soon as such power was beheld, the people called him Maker of Created Things, the Prince of All Things, the Father of the Sun. For they say that he performed other wonders, giving life to men and animals, so that by his hand marvelous great benefits were conferred on the people. In many places he gave orders to men how they should live. He spoke lovingly to them, admonishing them that they should do good, and that they should be loving and charitable to all. In many parts, he is generally called Tiki Viracocha, or Viracocha. And that wherever he came, there were sick, he healed them, and where they were blind, he gave them sight by only uttering words." End of quote. Now, How much for Pedro Cieza de Leon, this Catholic priest, is he mixing his own Christian belief of things? There's probably a pretty good chance that he did. But he's going to go on to describe that definitely there is this bearded white god who's going to come from the area way south near Lake Titicaca, where there's actually a great temple complex called Tiahuanaco, Bolivia, just on the south side, on the other side of Lake Titicaca, where there was a temple complex that looks very much like the Temple of Solomon in the way that it's constructed, with stones outside the main entrance. That's fascinating. But they believe that this god Viracocha had come from that direction. And so from that, you're going to see a lot of carvings if you travel in Peru of Viracocha. And Tiki Viracocha here is going to be this god, and he's always shown as holding out in his outstretched hands lightning bolts, one in each hand. He has a beard. He has sun rays coming usually from his head. But one of the things that I find intriguing about Viracocha and the images that you see of Viracocha is that he's very, very often shown as weeping for his people. So the fact that we have a weeping sun god is very, very interesting. Now, one of the interesting things then about Viracocha, the creator god, is that he's going to give birth and create Inti, the sun god. And Inti himself has he gives birth to four brothers. Now, put your cap on here and thinking about the Book of Mormon setting. There are these four brothers that are coming from the area of Lake Titicaca. The oldest of the brothers, they're called the four Ayar brothers. And the oldest brother, Ayarhachi, is angry and warlike. And he ends up being separated from the other brothers because he's so warlike. And so he will actually go back near Titicaca. The younger brother, Ayarmanco, and his wife, Mama Acelo, they are going to go south and found Cusco. They will teach people how to farm, how to use the rugged Andes as a place to set up terraces to grow potatoes and crops up the side of the Andes Mountains. And so Ayarmanco is then venerated as the founder and has some real interesting similarities, we would think, maybe to Nephi and being separated from his angry older brothers. Okay. So with all of that, then we get this, we get in the building up of around Cusco, just outside of that is a place called Sacsayhuaman, this massive temple complex that is surrounded by a massive, beautifully cut stoned set of walls, showing a massive temple city just outside of Cusco. Not far from that, if you're going to follow through what's now called the Sacred Valley, you go down through the Sacred Valley, and you're going to get another massive templed city, Ollantaytambo. And not far from Ollantaytambo, then what you're going to take a train and you're going to find the secreted sacred place of Machu Picchu. And you get the important thing for when Pizarro and the Spaniards came and were treated as the returning white god that we know about, in every one of these places, Cusco, Ollantaytambo, what you're finding is golded cities. There's rich abundance of gold that you don't find nearly as much in Mesoamerica, and you don't find any in the Heartland model. But golded city, all of the temples are covered with gold. And it's that that's going to cause the Spaniards to conquer. They're going to, some part of the, like the Aztecs will die because of the diseases that Europeans are bringing. But they're going to conquer Cusco. They're going to strip the cities of its gold, put them on ships, and haul them back to Spain. And everywhere you go, this is a very, very rich area. That's why you get these legends of these golden cities that are out there somewhere. And they tend to put them at Aztec gold, I think Pirates of the Caribbean. But really, all of this place is taking place more in Peru. So again, just interesting that there are a lot of evidences that I'm not going to go into today, that certainly a bearded white god came to visit the Peruvians. With a bearded white god appears to have come to the Mayans, to the Aztec. Again, we don't have those stories or any evidence for that in North America. The only question for me is, as the legends of what this bearded white god did mixes with the legends of the locals, whether they were Inca or whether they were pre-Inca or whether they were the Olmecs or whoever it was, you see the elements diffused into their myths, and you begin to say, yeah, somewhere around here this actually happened. This is possibly where it happened. Is there a possibility, sometimes we look at the Book of Mormon and say, is there a possibility that some of it, like the Old Testament, might have been a little bit mythological? With the Book of Mormon, much less of a possibility. I think the Book of Mormon makes a pretty good case for its own historicity. It's wanting to say, yeah, we lived, and we lived so much that we're going to keep very careful of our records. We're going to show in the Book of Mormon that we handed our records to the next generation, and that went on for 1,000 years, another 1,000 years with the Jaredites, and that those records ultimately ended up with a man, Moroni, well, Mormon, to put them together, compile them, abridge them. He's going to then give it to his son, Moroni. When Moroni then is going to somehow, in some way, he's going to get them to that hill in Palmyra for Joseph Smith to find the abridged version, the Reader's Digest version of this tale of two peoples. Where they lived is up for grabs. It's part of fun speculation. And again, disclaimer at the end, but none of those tell us that the Book of Mormon is true. The Book of Mormon is gonna want you by faith and by trust and by prayer to discover its truthfulness. Now, with that knowledge, then go have fun. Go take a look at the possibilities that might exist in Mesoamerica, or that it might have existed in Peru. You strain a bit, yes, you can get to the Heartland. But by and large, the vast majority of evidence says it's somewhere down there. So in trips and cruises and things like that, you get a chance to look. You get a chance to listen for those little stories woven in to the myths and be able to say, yeah, that I can see that, and I can see where they might have gotten. So anyway, bury my testimony, guys. Book of Mormon's true. The Book of Mormon is historical. And somewhere in the Americas, Nephi did live, Alma did live, and Moroni finished up the work of all of that. And I leave that with you in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.